So the final session, the final talk this afternoon will be a whole bunch of random thoughts from several random people on the future outstanding problems. But before that, we have two serious hardcore sessions, talks, both on how to combine various Bayesian spatial analyses of functional blobs across space and across subjects. The first of which, we're very fortunate to have Du Bois Bowman from Emory, and he's going to tell us about his work. Du Bois.
Thanks, Steve. Okay, can you hear me in the back okay? All right. So, as mentioned, I'm going to talk about a Bayesian hierarchical model, which incorporates, in addition to temporal correlations in the data, which were addressed earlier in the workshop, we'll also talk about spatial correlations between different voxels. Just a brief overview. I'll try to set the context by talking about the types of substantive questions that our method is applicable to, and then I'll talk about conventional analysis in very general terms. Many of you may already be familiar with those in detail. And then I'll present a specific study to you, and I'll use that study to help not only motivate the model, but I also will apply the model to data from that study and show you some results. So two fundamental philosophies that are very key to the model that I'll talk about are the ideas of functional specialization and also functional integration. For specialization, it's the idea that specific mental processes link to particular brain regions. And that's the heart of many neuroimaging, functional neuroimaging analyses, and we'll address those objectives as well. And then the other piece is functional integration, and that is more so how the specialized regions, brain regions, interact with one another, or associations or correlations between those regions. There are various modalities for acquiring functional neural images. My comments will primarily pertain, they're tailored primarily to fMRI, but some of the main concepts would also apply to PET and others as well. All right, so here's the situation that we're dealing with, where in a typical fashion, every subject will undergo a series of scans. So this cartoon depiction is a single subject being scanned at time one, or scan one, continuing to scan S. And the scans can all be linked to a given experimental task. Here, just as an example, I've used control and active to designate the experimental task. But there can be more than two. They can be arranged in a block design or event-related design. There's various flexibilities associated with how those are conducted. If we focus our attention just on a small piece of this cross-section, then each volume element or voxel will be indexed by V, which just can also give XYZ coordinates. When I get to presenting the model, V will be given as an index for voxels, and there are hundreds of thousands in our data at the time of analysis. Now, focusing our attention just on a single voxel, here I'll actually focus attention on three voxels. If we think about measuring brain activity over time, we have time series. So you'll see, forget the painting background that happens when I convert to PDF, but it'll go away in a moment. Okay, so focusing your attention, say, on this voxel, we see sort of a pattern of brain activity evolving over time from scan 1 to scan S. So again, naturally, we can think that there will be temporal correlations between the activity at one time point and another time point at a given location. But also, it's important to think that the brain activity in a particular location may link or have correlations with brain activity in different locations. So as a precursor to modeling, just to highlight a couple features of the data and frame them kind of in the context of regression, which will be forthcoming, the response is a localized measurement of brain activity, and those are temporally and spatially correlated. And then we can construct a design matrix with whose columns will essentially identify the scans or the experimental task under which scans were obtained, as well as other variables that we feel it's important to adjust for, but they're not interesting inherently in their own right to the study. There's a fair amount of pre-processing that we do, and my talk won't really cover those, but I don't want to be remiss, so I just to mention that we realign for motion correction and do things like spatial normalization, where we warp individuals' brains to a standard template, and then spatial smoothing. And I have an asterisk here because in my model, I'm going to do some spatial modeling, and so you can either apply the model to unsmooth data or apply the model to minimally smooth data, but we don't want to smooth too aggressively and then sort of benefit from that smoothing by modeling some of those same correlations. Okay, so functional specialization topics have largely been addressed by what are called activation studies. And again, we just want to identify specific regions of the brain that are differentially activated under different tasks. That's done at a voxel level, often using what's called, what we refer to as random effects analyses, implemented in the brain imaging community, usually in two stages, where at the first stage, we model data on each individual separately. We take summary statistics from that model, like the regression coefficients, and we combine them in a group level model at stage two to try to get some grasp on population parameters. We can use those then to construct test statistics and then threshold the test statistics to try to find specific voxels in the brain that are statistically significant. Also, region of interest analyses are of interest, where we define a region a priori and we'll average the activity across all of the voxels in that region and proceed as though the data represent one location and then proceed with analysis there. To date, those have generally been pursued by separate analyses, but one benefit of the model that I'll talk about is that it combines these two objectives into a unified framework. Functional integration has been addressed through what are called connectivity studies, and there are functional connectivity and effective connectivity. There are some components that I'll highlight for you later in the talk that address certain types of functional connectivity, that is the correlations between distinct brain regions or remote neurophysiologic events, as it was originally defined in a 93 paper by Carl Friston. As a part of this, we can think of local correlations, that is, to what extent do voxels that are nearby correlate with one another. But then we're well aware that there are bundles of axonal fibers that connect relatively distant areas of the brain. Therefore, it often arises that we may have similarities in function between two voxels that are relatively distant. So we want to make sure we're mindful of that and that our model has some ability to capture some of those correlations. All right, moving on to the data. The data, again, comes from an fMRI study of inhibitory control in cocaine addicts. And a hallmark feature of cocaine addiction is the inability to regulate drug-seeking behavior despite the knowledge of adverse consequences associated with use. And it's thought that the compromised inhibitory control might also exist in more generalized settings that aren't related to drug-seeking behavior. And so this particular study looked at one of those more generalized settings and wanted to look at the neural processing involved in attempts to regulate control or behavior. So there were 28 subjects, 12 cocaine addicts, 16 controls that we considered in this analysis. The study conditions, there were multiple conditions, but the ones that I'll focus on in this talk relates again to inhibitory control, and it essentially was correctly inhibiting a prepotent response. So subjects, as they lie in a scanner, were primed with a go cue, and they were told to respond by way of button press whenever they saw the go cue. And so they became accustomed to responding, but they were told whenever the go cue was followed by an auditory tone to try to refrain from pressing the button. So that's what we refer to as the stop signal. And the stop signal occurred on 16% of the trials. And so as they became very accustomed to it, they would all of a sudden have to try to refrain or regulate their behavior. to suppress pressing the button. Okay, there were two sessions. The addicts went away for an 8-week intensive behavioral therapy and were brought back afterwards for scanning. The controls, we obviously didn't treat them, but to parallel this pre-post design, they underwent baseline scans. After 8 weeks, they were brought back in for follow-up scans. Many of you are already aware of the amount of data that you have in fMRI analyses. I often talk to statisticians who are less familiar, so this next line is just sort of to impress upon them the point that there's lots of data, which is important because you have to sort of think simply and then build up in a progressive fashion, because you don't want to jump in with modeling that's too complicated or you're likely to run into computational problems. The objective that we'll consider here is to look at treatment emergent neural processing changes related to response inhibition in the cocaine addicts. And we'll for adjustment, do that relative to the differences in the controls. All right, a few considerations before I move into the heart of the spatial modeling techniques that we use. One is again, this concept of distance in the brain. In statistics, it's a very common assumption in spatial modeling to assume that things further apart are less correlated than things close together. And that may be true in the brain in some instances, but again, we have these long-range axonal fibers and allowing different areas of the brain to interact. So that's something that is a bit more challenging in our case. The amount of data that we have billions of voxel pairs, so it's first of all going to be difficult to estimate those in a reasonable amount of time. Secondly, even if we did estimate them, what are we going to do with them? We want something relatively simple to interpret. I'll talk about a spatial Bayesian hierarchical model for addressing some of these, and this stems from some previous work that I won't really talk about today, but I give references here in case you're interested. All right, elaborating now on just, you know, the extent to which things far apart may be functionally more similar in some cases than things close together, these maps show what I call a functional distance. So it's just this Euclidean-looking distance here, but instead of having the location for voxel I and location for voxel J, this is a vector representing, say, the mean activity associated with different tasks. And so by looking then at this quadratic form, the square root of this quadratic form, we're actually able to determine how similar or dissimilar the distance in a functional sense to voxels are. So this is red, which indicates a small distance, meaning the two voxels are functionally similar. This is blue, indicating dissimilarity. Hopefully you can see these crosshairs in the back, but what I've done in the two maps is I've selected a given voxel, and then the colors in the remainder of the map indicate the functional proximity to the selected voxel. Okay, so sort of as expected, we see this red right around the neighborhood of this voxel. So you have this local similarity. But then we also have this bilateral similarity. So after kind of increasing dissimilarity, then as we get a little bit further, we have areas that are more similar. And then this area in the orbital frontal cortex here is also quite similar, although again, it's relatively distant. And so that's what we want to be mindful of, again, when posing a spatial model. And this, the same information, just selecting a different box. So you can actually go dynamically on this map and just select around for different boxes and it'll automatically update with the functional distances. Okay, so with that in mind, I'll now go into the spatial modeling approach that we use. So off the bat, we wanted to try to simplify in a reasonable way. And of course, whenever you make assumptions, there are things that are lost, but the idea is to just use assumptions that are somewhat tenable and that it will allow both easier interpretations as well as easier computations. And so what we do is we first parcelate the brain into different regions. And there are a number of options that you have to do this. I've listed here anatomical regions, something like AAL or Brodmann regions, to separate the brain into distinct areas. But you also could use data-driven regions, clustering or ICA. And I'll come back to that because there are gains for doing the data-driven approaches, but also there are some things that are lost. But nonetheless, what we do is first segment the brain into regions, and then what we'll try to do is capture certain types of correlations within regions, and then also try to capture correlations between regions. So those will represent sort of the local and long-range counterparts for correlations in our model. We heard about the two-stage modeling approach that's common in functional neuroimaging earlier, and we, in our work, build upon this so that the first stage model is essentially equivalent to the stage one analysis that's done in a routine, say, statistical parametric mapping for random effects type analyses. So this is just a regression model. Just to introduce you to the notation, this will be a vector of bold responses for the ith subject at voxel v. This index g denotes the region to which voxel v belongs. Here it's a bit redundant because the voxel is the more precise unit of measurement, but it'll be important on the next slide, so I have it listed here. This is the design matrix and the parameters of interest, again, for the ith subject. And these are simply, that sort of parallels this, but these are parameters that are not of that we're not inherently interested in. So again, things like drift that we may adjust for, or movement. And then these are a vector of error terms. You'll see listed here that the errors are assumed to be independent. This is, again, the first stage modeling. So the assumption here is that by showing this independence, we've assumed that the data have already been pre-whitened. So in a similar fashion that Steve talked about earlier, we can address temporal correlations at the first stage modeling within this framework. Okay. So now, before moving on to the second, what we're going to do, I want to focus your attention to this parameter vector, because this is what we take to the next stage and model to try to get group-level estimates. But instead of fitting just a simple regression model for these parameters at the second stage, we're now going to actually fit a spatial Bayesian hierarchical model, which is given here. So this may look complicated at first glance, but it's actually just kind of a series of relatively simple models, and I'll try to highlight some of the more important points. This, again, is the parameter from the first stage model, again, for the ith subject and voxel v region G. Now there's an additional index J, which denotes the experimental task. And this also could be a contrast, so the difference between experimental tasks if we were interested in doing that. Given these parameters of interest, we assume that this follows a normal distribution with mean mu gj at voxel v. And this is highlighted in blue because this is the population parameter at the voxel level that we're interested in. And that's equivalent to what we usually are after when we do a second stage analysis where we're estimating population parameters in statistical parametric mapping. So that's what we really want to make inferences about. But there are other things in the model that we'll also want to address as well. Okay, in typical Bayesian fashion, we want to express some uncertainty about this parameter by expressing a prior distribution, and we do that there. And we say that this follows a normal distribution with a regional mean. So every voxel in a given region is given the same prior mean. If this is a contrast of interest instead of just an effect, then it might be safe to assume that this is zero. So we can adjust that for a specific analysis. Another thing that I want to focus your attention on here are the random effects here. This is a random effect for the ith subject. And by pooling across all of the regions G, so here they're concatenated in a vector. So this is G equal to 1 all the way to the last region. We can express a prior distribution here where there's this covariance matrix gamma. And that covariance matrix will have off-diagonal elements, which represents the covariances or the correlations between regions. So that's important because that incorporates the long-range correlations between regions. Okay, and the rest are fairly straightforward prior specifications, and these are some details on the hyper-prior parameters. Our approach with specifying these things were to specify what are called minimally informative priors. Some of you will be familiar with what that means, but it just means that we don't want to express beliefs that are too specific a priori. And for those of you who are less familiar with Bayesian analyses, I recently gave a talk at OHBM that gives more introductory remarks to Bayesian analyses. I don't think you have to have it to understand what I'm talking about here, but if you are interested, you can see that talk as well. And there are lots of great books on Bayesian analyses as well. For estimation, we use Markov chain Monte Carlo methods, where we draw samples from the joint posterior distribution and get hundreds of or get thousands of samples, and then we can use those to estimate things like the mean of a parameter. We can make probability statements about parameters. So you have a very flexible framework. Once you have the sample, then all of the information that you need is in the posterior distribution, and you have some flexibility on how you arrange those things for inferences. One thing that is very important to us is this idea of intra-regional correlation. And that can be defined as this parameter here. These are the diagonal terms in that covariance matrix that I had highlighted previously. And this is just one of the variance parameters at the level of the data in the model. But by looking at this ratio, that gives an estimate of the correlation between voxels within regions. And if there are any other functions of the parameters that are of interest, because you have samples from the joint posterior, you can easily estimate those. I should comment too that estimation here is relatively fast, so about 20 minutes or so at the second stage. So although we're doing MCMC, it doesn't lead to very long calculations in this context. All right, now moving on to results, to address this objective, we're basically going to look at this contrast. So post-treatment activity in the patients minus pre-treatment activity in the patients. And again, to adjust for sort of the pre-post scanning that we do, the repeated measures aspects, we subtract off the corresponding difference in the controls. Okay, so we're going to look for areas where this difference is larger than this difference. Okay, or there's a high probability that A is greater than zero. These are the inferences that we target. Again, voxel-specific activations, also regional activations. So those are analogous to the region of interest inferences that are sometimes performed in a separate analyses. And then we have information on within region task-related functional connectivity, and then between region task-related functional connectivity. I use this task-related functional connectivity because we're really capturing correlations between the summary statistics from the first stage. But in essence, you know, even if you're looking at the raw time series, it still depends somewhat on what the individuals are doing in the scanner. Okay, so these are similar to the typical voxel level activation maps that you see, except instead of these representing areas that are statistically significantly greater than zero at a given p-value, we express them as probability statements. So here it's just the probability that the event A defined on the previous slide is greater than zero. This shows voxels for which that probability is greater than or equal to 0.7. Okay, and so we see significant in quotes activation here in the orbital frontal cortex, the left thalamus, and then along the cingulate gyrus. Okay, so we always want to retain the ability to get voxel level inferences, because I think usually people do want to localize at that level. But we also have now a natural framework to look at region-level analyses as well. And that's what this map shows. The green are areas where this probability is greater than zero, thresholding here at 0.80. So again, we saw this at the voxel-level activation, this orbital frontal cortex or gyrus rectus, as well as here. The blue regions here are areas that are deactivated. So just flipping this inequality, the probability that this event A is less than zero with high probability. Okay, now moving on to the correlations, we're first going to concentrate on correlations within regions, and I've selected just 11 regions here to focus our attention on, and then we'll look at correlations between regions. Within regions, and again, these are aligned as addicts, baseline, post-treatment, and then controls, baseline, and follow-up. And the striking thing to me is not the difference between the addicts and the controls, which I think initially was of interest to my collaborators, but more afterwards, things look like they are much more highly correlated within each region than they are at baseline. So there's some type of learning that makes voxels within regions exhibit more coherent brain activity follow this the second time around, whether it's following treatment or just coming in for a second set of scans. We can actually do testing, but there were no, again, notable differences between the addicts and controls here. But if we want to test those, we can look at, again, probability statements. There also are things called Bayes factors that allow us to make decisions about either for model fitting or whether or not there's evidence to support a specific scientific hypothesis. The interregional, now these are between regions for the same 11 selected regions, and I'll show you these one of these on a map, but just first looking at it in a correlation matrix, we convert this gamma to a correlation matrix as follows, and I just show pairs of regions that have relatively high correlations. Along the diagonal, we're going to have one, so things are perfectly correlated. Above, I show, just for convenience, I show things that are negatively correlated. Below the main diagonal, things that are positively correlated. And the important thing is that there are some things that are highly correlated. And the typical analysis would not capture these. It would assume that those were all zeros just by doing the sort of mass univariate approach by looking at each voxel in each region separately. I'll show this on a map because it's easier to interpret in some ways with anatomy underlying. So these are the yellow, again, these are the same exact results that were in the covariance matrix. Again, thresholding here at 0.5, but now I show in yellow those that are extremely high above 0.75. And so we see that there's a network here of regions that show high correlations with respect to those summary statistics in the first stage, which is really important. It doesn't say anything about cause and effect relationship, but just more the functional connectivity that there are high correlations between those regions. A few other considerations there. We did some sensitivity analyses to choice of priors. We actually did lots of simulations and things like that to make sure that our model really captured what we wanted it to capture. The component that was the most sensitive was the choice of how we seeded the covariance matrix. And essentially what we did was to vary the correlations, the strength of the correlations on this to do the sensitivity analysis. And overall, what we found is that the mean results hardly changed at all. There were negligible changes, so that at the region level and the voxel level, pretty much what we saw was what we saw. With respect to the connectivity inferences or estimates, we did see some changes there, but none of them were very drastic. In other words, the things that had very high correlations were still high even after we tweaked the prior specifications. So generally, the model was fairly robust to changes in the prior. Convergence diagnostics is something to be mindful of, as it is really in any case, but for the regional level parameters, we're able to do the typical things to assess model convergence. For the voxel level, because we have hundreds of thousands of voxels, we selected a subset of voxels to look at, and we had some other quantitative criteria that we used. But that's always an issue when you're doing large MCMC analyses for estimation. One other thing that I wanted to mention is that this gives a framework for assessing changes in task-related functional connectivity, either looking at differences between groups or differences, say, pre-post-treatment. And to do so, you can look at sort of at normalization, so to speak. So differences in the patient's pre- and post-treatment relative to the controls, and how after treatment, which differences were smaller? In other words, more like the controls. And so you can do any number of things like that. And again, the flexibility of having estimates from the joint posterior distribution, anything that you can think of that you can write a function of the model parameters, you're able to estimate because you have the samples there. Okay, with that, I will end, and I'd like to thank my collaborators. The talk primarily stems from this 2008 paper, and my collaborators or co-authors are highlighted here in bold: Clint Kilts, Brian Caffo, and Susan Spear Bassett. But we also had help from others at Emory: Gordana Dorado, Tim Ely, and Robin Groh. So I'd like to acknowledge their contributions as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have questions?
Yeah. Can you go back to slide 19, please?
19?
Yeah.
Yep.
Just there's difference between the controls baseline performance and follow-up performance in the video region escalated connectivity. And how would you explain that? Because they didn't do any kind of training, if I got it wrong.
Training with respect to the experimental paradigm?
Yeah. Here you can see on the bottom graphs, if you compare the baseline with the follow-up,
uh-huh.
there is a big difference in the video region escalated connectivity.
Sure.
Can you summarize the question?
Sure, I'll summarize. In a nutshell, the question centers, how do you explain this? That there wasn't any training, so how do you explain sort of the increase or the change in within region correlations before and after treatment or baseline and follow-up with the controls? And I can speculate. I don't know for sure, but one thing may just be that you're more acclimated to the task, you're more acclimated to your environment, and so there may be the task itself is not as novel. And perhaps with that, you have increased coherence in the activity in certain regions when performing it, when it's not a novel task relative to the initial time point. So that's one speculation.
Thank you.
Yes?
How do you define the regions for the region that's
the regions, in the analysis that I used, I segmented based on the AAL map, which segments the brain. It's there was a 19. Let's make sure I get it right. 2002 paper that I used to base that segmentation or parcellation on. But there's some flexibility there. So actually, in some of the previous work that I did, I used a data-driven approach, and so I'd like to just comment on that briefly, where we did clustering based on the functional distances to separate the brain into different regions, and there are some benefits, I think, to doing that, because you're sort of ensuring in some sense that things within a cluster are fairly similar. The downside sometimes are interpretations. So out of, let's say, 22 clusters, you may get 12 that seem to make sense, but then you'll get some others that it's hard to interpret, it's hard to explain. The other notable thing about that is, when you do that, or if you were to use ICA, for example, as an alternative, by definition, different regions should not really be dependent on one another. And so this interregional correlation thing sort of loses some of its appeal or meaning in that context. But nonetheless, data-driven alternatives do represent a viable alternative.
I'd like to ask you a couple of questions sequentially, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
The first one is, could you explain the intuition for when you have an area that has multiple voxels?
Mm-hmm.
How do you determine if it is activated? Do you pick a percentage of voxels? Or is there something on the model that it has a common parameter for the entire region that I missed? I'm sorry.
Very good. So just to reiterate the question, for regional level activations, how do we determine that? Is it some percentage of voxels or it raises a very good point, so I'd like to just make the point and then in the same vein answer the question. For a regional level activation, it doesn't mean that every voxel in the region is activated. It just means that there's sufficient in the information in that region to declare activation for the entire region. And essentially what we do is we can average, after we have estimates from the model parameters from this joint distribution, we can pool across those just by averaging across the voxel. And so that it can be either one of two ways. There are enough voxels that have reasonably large or clear evidence of activation, or a few focal voxels that have strong enough where they provide enough evidence to kind of carry the weight for the other voxels in the region.
And the second question is, could you provide some intuition for the following? It seems to me that in comparison with a standard GLM model, you have done two things. First, you have relaxed the assumption that there are not intra-areas or special correlations, you have relaxed that, but you could have done that in a non-Bayesian approach, and then you have done the Bayesian part. So, and it also sounds like you have imposed restrictions on the correlations based on the areas, across areas. So what part of the results is due to the first part, to the relaxation of the no spatial correlation, and what part of the results is due to the Bayesian approach?
So the Bayesian versus frequentist approach, this was sort of the third piece of work that we did along the same line. Actually both of the earlier models were not framed in a Bayesian structure. In a non-Bayesian structure, we used maximum likelihood for estimation. And what we found when moving, so that the just to recap very briefly, what we didn't do in that context was capture the between region correlations. So we captured correlations within regions, but what was lacking was the between region correlation. So we wanted to relax that assumption because we thought, well, even if you do a data driven approach and things are relatively uncorrelated, you still could have some of these long range correlations. Or if we used a different way to break things into region, then it may be even more likely that these things were correlated. And so we wanted to relax that assumption, but in doing so, that we ran into estimation problems in the maximum likelihood framework. So we, in the initial case, we were able to implement Fisher scoring algorithms. So we took derivatives of the likelihood function and we could do all of that, but we found that when we tried to extend the model in that conceptually simple way, that the model itself or the computations became much more complex. And so that's why we ended up in the Bayesian framework, which I think is natural, because with a complex model you can simplify it by just stratifying it sort of across the layers of the hierarchy so that it's not all pieced in one model. Now, in terms of the results, I think you get similar benefits whether you do a Bayesian approach or frequentist approach, and that's that you gain strength from pooling information across related voxels in your estimation. So with a mass univariate approach, you look at only information within a single voxel. Here, you have other voxels sort of contributing information to the estimation of a voxel level parameter, which I think is what reduces the variability, therefore allowing us to gain strength.
20 minutes for an NCMC sounded pretty short to me. What's the relationship of that to the number of regions you're choosing, and are you doing anything special to achieve that 20-minute run, forcing convergence using some modern procedure?
Okay, good question. The question was on computing time. 20 minutes seems relatively short for MCMC, and indeed it is. We don't, other than attempts to do clever programming from a group of authors who are not professional programmers, we try to do as much clever programming as we can to reduce time, and we did achieve some things like that, but we're not making any restrictions per se to reduce the computing time. It doesn't really rely so much on the number of subjects or the number of regions that are involved. The number of regions will affect it, but not drastically so. So if you have more regions, then there are more parameters to estimate, but it's not as though you move from 20 minutes to 3 hours or something like that. The primary benefit of how we've stipulated the model that allows the fast computation is that we can use Gibbs sampler. So we have kind of a series of priors that are conjugate priors, and there's a closed form or a well-known distribution. So it's fairly easy, therefore, to draw samples in that context and to sort of track how you're doing.
Well,
so
I'm thinking that probably the main point here is you're not doing it voxel-wise at that stage. So it's not, you're not running that for every voxel, it's across the regions.
Right.
Is there a question over here? No more? I have, yes, there was.
Sorry.
Okay.
So you're treating all the regions similarly, however big or small they are, or whichever region it is. Like, some regions are known to do a lot of different things. You treat them differently from regions which are pretty homogeneous.
We don't do anything to distinguish voxels within a region. We do have voxel level parameters though. So if there are differences in activity between voxels in the region, that should be picked up just because we have voxel specific parameters. We don't force ourselves to combine across those. And that becomes important at the regional level, right? When you summarize across a region, but just in terms of presenting a distributed map of brain activity or differential brain activity patterns, we don't force those to be homogeneous in any way. There is an assumption, there is sort of an exchangeability assumption between voxel pairs within a region that might relate to that comment as well. So, if you have a region consisting of a smaller number of voxels and the activity is relatively homogeneous, then that would be picked up by that parameter row that we addressed here. And then also just the fact that you have more information for a voxel, so there may be less variability. If you were to look at the distribution of certain parameters in a region, the voxels that have lots of region may show sort of a more peaked distribution than voxels that have fewer parameters, because naturally the variability will be smaller in those larger ones.
Can I ask a question? So what's your experience with respect to the issue of the accuracy of the AAL anatomical regions as projected onto all of the different subjects? Obviously, there is this issue of spatial variability. Uh-huh. How much do you think that interacts as a problem with this approach?
Uh-huh. It's a good question, and we don't really try to attack that in our analysis. There will be differences in sort of neural anatomy even after warping to a standard template, and that's an argument for smoothing, but again, we would recommend in that case to just smooth sort of minimally to adjust for some of those. So with increases, So with improved methods that are more accurate for segmenting different brain regions, that could naturally be incorporated into our framework without any problem. So that wasn't sort of at the heart of our approach, but some of those considerations are important.
Okay, we'll take a 10-minute coffee break and then back for more. Thank you.